So we are in Perek Yud Gimel, chapter 13. And I'd like to dedicate the learning for Rafua Shlema for Meira Bas Chana. So we are in the middle of a message to Bavel. Last time we did the introduction to this overall section, which runs from Prakim Yud Gimel to Chaf Gimel, chapters 13 to 23, in which Yeshaya speaks about punishments coming to the nations of the region. We talked a lot about who his audience is. Clearly it's really us, and what it is that he wants to convey. We had a particularly interesting idea from Erel Siegel suggesting that he's trying to tell us don't bother making alliances with the nations around us, because everyone's time comes when God chooses, each of these nations will fall. We talked about when these are communicated, not going back to that right now. But the message to Babylon, to Bavel, is clearly a message about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, saying that you became arrogant, you became haughty, and therefore you will collapse as well. Of course, as we said, destruction of the temple has not happened at this stage. The Babylonians have not yet come onto our scene at this stage. They are, at this moment in history, a backwater. In the lull in between Hammurabi's era much earlier and the Neo-Babylonian era that Nebuchadnezzar will preside over. So we began after the opening line with the prediction of Bavel, Babylon in ruins. And we described that the warriors who will destroy Bavel are God's warriors. Giborai, Alizei Ga'avati, Mikudashai. They belong to God. God is their commander. And Bavel was described in panicked tremors, like a woman in labor. And we noted the way that played out in the verbs here, a description of the muscles going limp and then the muscles spasming. It was a contraction. And we said that either that's meant to describe their fear, like the fear of someone in labor, or alternatively, it was meant to add a dimension and say there's a birth going on here. Because as Bavel falls, that opens the door for the Persians to allow the Jews to go back and build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the second temple, which you're going to see as well in the beginning of chapter 14. So it's going to fit very nicely that the fall of Babylon is twinned with the rise of Judea, so that, yes, it's the pain and the fear associated with birth, but it's also the arrival of a new life. And of course, the highlight of that was the Shalshelet, that note from the Trop that appeared on Viniv Halu as part of that section, and that was the beginning of sentence 8. So what we're now going to do is talk about the destruction in sentences 9 to 13. If you look at your sheet, because it's so easy to get lost in the morass of you're going to fall, you're going to fall, you're going to fall, it's going to get hurt. I shouldn't say that. Bavel is going to collapse, Bavel is going to be in ruins, and so on. Because of the of just the weight of it, it's hard to distinguish all the nuances all along, and so I broke it out as an outline. And you can see there, the sections are divided up based on nuances within and different focuses within what Yeshaya says. So the first section that we're going to see today, sentences 9 to 13, if you're using the stone Tanakh, you want the bottom of page 975, is a description of the devastation as universal. And I'm not going to read out all of the sentences, again, as I asked in the email for people to read in advance, because that helps a lot. I'm just going to highlight how the sentences show that it is universal. So the description here in sentences 9 to 13, if you take a look at sentence 10, it talks about Kochavei Hashamayim Uchasilehem, the stars in the heavens and their Kisil. Kisil is usually associated with a particular constellation in the sky. But the point is, the stars in the heavens will not provide light, the sun will go dark, the moon will not shine forth with its light. So all of the heavens are complicit and part of this devastation. Abar Benel suggests that there may be an astrological element to this as well, which is very interesting. But in sentence 10, you talk about the heavens going dark. In sentence 11, you talk about God bringing bad upon it tevel. The word tevel is an interesting word. They translate it here as the earth. That makes it an uninteresting word. What does tevel actually mean? Sorry?
I'm sorry to interrupt. Katzala is here just to see you for five minutes. Is that okay to make sure you're okay?
Sorry.
It's kind of a procedure.
The idea of tevel is not only about earth. The idea of tevel is from the word yivul. What is yivul?
Produce.
Right. Yivul is produce. So tevel is civilization more than earth. It's the productive earth. It's where people have built up their cities and their nations. That's what tevel is, and God is going to bring devastation upon tevel. And then it continues in sentence 13, talking about Shamayim argiz v'tirash haaretz. The heavens, God says, will shake. God is going to make the heavens shake and the land shake. And as Ibn Ezra notes, there is no escape. It's going to be everywhere. That's what's going to happen to Babylon. So the question you have to ask here, maybe Janine's about to ask it.
That pasuk between Okir and Okir doesn't seem to fit in.
Well,
the destruction. What does he say that?
I think it's a statement of total destruction. Okir and Osh Mipaz means
They're endeared to me.
Not so much. The word yakar, this is the flip side of something being valuable. The word yakar, which we use often for honor or for something that is valuable, right, has a positive and a negative. The positive of being valuable is it's desirable. The negative of being valuable is that often it's valuable because it's rare. Okir anosh mipaz means people will be more rare than gold. That's the idea. And the term yakar is often used to connote something, in fact, being rare, being hard to find. So, Okir anosh mipaz is a statement that it's a testament to the extent of the devastation. People will be rarer than gold. Man will be, again, more rare than ketem ophir, which is also a term for precious gold. So yeah, I think it does fit, and it will lead in well to the next part, which is going to talk about the totality of devastation as well. But why is this presented in such universal terms? It's just Babylon. Why are we talking about it as though all the heavens and all the earth? Susan?
Wasn't Babylon considered at this time the center of the civilization?
Right. So Susan's approach is Ibn Ezra's approach. If you take a look at source number 2, on the sheet, Ibn Ezra writes, "Ufakadati al tevel ra'a." I will bring terrible things upon tevel. Why? Kimamlachot rabot tafas koresh. Because Cyrus, when the Persians conquered the Babylonians, takes many empires. It's not a local thing. Babylon is everywhere. Right, Nebuchadnezzar talks about the extent of his conquest. He's rather proud of it. So that's certainly one way to look at it. What else could you give as an answer? So Rashi's answer, if you take a look at source number 1, Rashi's answer is that this is really only narrow. This is really only Bavel's experience. But to the person who's experiencing it, it's the end of the world. If you take a look at Rashi, he says, Chashach HaShemesh, the sun darkened, mitoch tzaratam, in their trouble, nidmelehem ki'ilu Chashach HaShemesh. It seemed like the sun had gone dark. Right? Those who are not of Bavel don't notice anything different. But to them, this is literally the end of the world. So that's another way to look at it. I would add a third dimension to this, which is, you know, a little hard to fit in because we only really do this with Babel. We don't do it with all the nations. Nonetheless, there is a sense in general, in Tanakh, that the whole world exists for the sake of the divine plan. All of creation is meant to make the plan come true. So, for example, in Bereshit, when we get the list of creation day by day by day, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, Yom Revi'i, day 2, 3, 4, you get to day 6, it says Yom Hashishi, the sixth day, standard midrash on that says the sixth day, because there's going to be another day six that's really important, the sixth of Sivan, which is the day when the Torah is given. The Torah might have been given on the seventh of Sivan, but we'll ignore that. The day the Torah is given is the sixth of Sivan, and what the Medrash says is, this is called the sixth day because what God creates on this day, which is humanity, is not firm until the next day six shows up and we accept the Torah, and at that point everything becomes set. It's all worth creating. So you could similarly say over here that the destruction of Babel is part of God's universal plan, and and that's what it's trying to show, the centrality of Israel to divine plans and deeds. The stars, the earth, they're all participants in this. You follow? So that's another way to look at it. Okay. So that's the universal destruction. But then you get a particularly interesting section where you get, as I titled it on the sheet, the cruelest devastation. And here we introduce a nation named Madai. So we're going to have to talk about Madai. But the basic character here is a cruel invasion in which everybody must flee. If you take a look at source number four, sentence number 14, sorry, Parakut Gimel Pasuk Yadalit, page 977. I have a particular reason for reading the sentence. He, sounds like Babylon, will be like a deer that is chased away. Like sheep with none to gather them. Each one will run to his nation, each one will flee to his land, and then it continues, and all those who don't, all those who are found, will be stabbed and fall by the sword, and so on and so on and so on. Who is fleeing here?
Who weren't there originally.
So that's what Abarbanel highlights in source number 3. Abarbanel highlights these are foreigners. It doesn't make sense to say it's Babylonians because then they're in their own land. So I'm just pointing that out, that it could be referring to foreigners. And those who do not flee, those who are not successful, will be killed mercilessly. Them, their children, the wives of the world, everybody is gone. Why? Sentence 17. Hineni me'ir aleihem es madai. I am bringing madai, usually translated as media, M-E-D-E-A, or M-E-D-I-A, if you want. They didn't care. But madai is coming. And here you get a fascinating description in sentence 17 of this madai. I am bringing madai upon you. Asher kesef lo yachshovu. They don't care about silver. Vizahav lo yachbetzuvo. And they don't want gold. Madai is not concerned about the money. What's the point of stressing that?
You can't buy them off.
You can't buy them off, right. You can't pay them off. Right, this is a region of the world in which you make alliances, and in particular you make alliances with those who are the biggest threat. So that's what Judea did, right? When Ahaz was afraid, so he made a deal with the Assyrians. So you're going to think, Babel, that you can buy off the Medes. You can't buy off the Medes. They're not interested. They're not in it for the money. This is particularly interesting just as an image in Tanakh in general. I didn't give you the reference here on the sheet, and we're not going to look it up, but I'm mentioning it. In Shoftim Perek Hay, in Judges chapter 5, sentence 19, Devorah sings about the victory over Canaan. And she talks about, if you want to look it up at some point, it's chapter 5, 19. She talks about all the forces and fighters who supported Canaan against us and did not do it for money. They did it just as volunteers. They didn't even want the spoils. Who else does that bring to mind? Achashverosh. Right? Achashverosh says, Akesef nason lach, you can take the money. Right? I'm giving you the money, depending on how you read that sentence.
But also for the Jews, it said when the Jews Shushan their place were killing the people. They didn't take Shalil. They didn't take.
Right. Well, the point that's being made there, when the Megillah says we didn't take the spoils, their point there is to say this wasn't a power grab or a money grab. Right. This was just defense of ourselves because we were licensed to do it and we didn't do it. But in terms of attackers, and in terms of Ahasuerus, this is a statement of this is ideological. And therefore they can't be bribed and they can't be appeased. And Bavel, you're in trouble. Yeah.
Maybe I'm sending them to do my job.
Yeah.
It isn't so much that it's ideological as it is they were chosen to do this job and they're not going to do anything else, but they are going to do that.
Well, the thing is that it describes it in terms of their motivation. Right? If you look at the language in sentence 17, Kesef lo yachshobu, they don't consider silver meaningful. So that's why I'm looking at it in terms of their personal investment. They also don't know that God is sending them.
Of course not.
Yeah. Susan.
Maybe that's really why.
Okay.
It bothers me so much about when it says, you know, women will be ravished and babies will be killed.
Yeah.
And we're skipping over, but
no, we're not. I'm coming back to it. That's my next note.
Okay.
But go ahead. No, but go ahead.
To me, it's very troublesome. You've got babies. Okay, you don't want to throw off those Babylonians, but they're babies. You could take them with you, killing with, ravishing with it.
It's life for life, though. I'm going to do to them what they did.
No, but this is
that's not Judaism.
No, but this isn't about Judaism. This isn't about Judaism.
No, but this total description is.
This is a prediction of what is going to befall Babylon at the hands of media, with the Jews powerlessly watching as the slaves of Babylon. We're not—we're on the losing team in this battle, in the sense that we're Babylonians rather than Medes.
But they're going to leave the Jews alone. They're not going to.
Oh, even better. They're going to send us back to build the temple. But that's
right.
Well, that hasn't happened at this stage. But
no,
yes,
but
we're talking about that.
But when they're talking here, they're only talking about doing this to the Babylonians.
Correct. This is what the Medes are going to do to Babel. I keep going back and forth on my sheets, and as I speak, going back and forth between Babel and Babylon. I hope it's clear to people what I'm talking about. Paul.
Nevertheless, the point is still, I mean, when I talk to atheists and secularists and so forth, and talk about the values and the virtues of Judaism, they will, or even in writings that you read, they will point to this kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt.
Indiscriminate slaughter.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And it's a good topic, but it's not for right now. If you go on YU Torah and you search for Yehoshua chapter 3 and me, you'll find a shiur that I gave where I talked a lot about this issue as part of an introduction to the conquests that go on in the book of Yehoshua. So I talked about it there, the whole ethnic cleansing narrative, the whole bit. So it's worth. I think it's worth a listen, not because I have such wonderful things to say, but because I have some sources that I quote that do have wonderful things to say. But yeah, this is something that you do have to contend with as you read Tanakh, and the person who doesn't, I think, is missing significant points. So I agree with you for raising the issue. It's just Yeshaya. but I did want to go into sentence 16. It's just that I had written it in my notes after 17 for reasons that are not clear to me. But I referenced something for you in number 4, which will be familiar to you, Susan, from a discussion that we had in Nehemiah. Before you look at that, go back to sentence 16, please, and specifically in the Hebrew. The last word in the sentence says what? So Susan says.
But then there's a tif underneath.
Yeah, which is. Tisha Chavna. Right. Tisha Chavna versus Tisha Galna. And the question is, why do I have two different words? This is not the first time that happens. The honor of that is in Devarim, chapter 28, sentence 30. In the Tochacha, in its prediction of the suffering that will befall the Jews if they don't obey God's command, so an invader is described as arriving, and among other things the invader does, same thing. It says in the text, Tisha Chavna, they will rape the women, it's written Tisha Galna, but it's pronounced Tisha Chavna. You don't read the word that is written inside. So the question then is, why? What is this all about? Did you just look it up? Yep. Okay.
I always thought that the one we substitute for is not a very nice word, so you don't say it.
That the one we're substituting for is not a nice word.
Yeah.
So Radak thinks it's the opposite. Radak believes it's the opposite. The word that's written is a nice word. The word you say is the not nice word. And I'll show you where he says it. He doesn't say it here. He says it on the only other case of substitution that we have, which appears in Devarim 28, and also appears in Shmuel, and also, well, no, that's it. It appears in Devarim 28, and also appears in Shmuel. There is a word which appears in the text, and then is pronounced differently. The word in the text of the Torah, I'm not going to spell it out, but you can look at the verse that I referenced in number 4 if you want to see it, is apolim. Apolim. The way it's pronounced is tichorim. What are tichorim and what are apolim? So the word tichorim is generally understood to be a reference, I apologize in advance, to hemorrhoids. Some kind of bowel problem, hemorrhoid related perhaps, depends on the commentators there. Yes, or hemorrhoids, depending, you know, you say potato, I say potato. But that's the word, tchorim, is the way you pronounce it. What does apolim mean, the word that's actually written? Take a look at source number 4. Radak says, Haktiv hu shen kinui letachtoniyot. The written word is a euphemism for bowels. Ki apoli, lashon gvohot. Apoli is a term for heights. And I gave you a reference there in parentheses to Nehemiah. Do you remember when we went around the wall around Yerushalayim that Nehemiah built? There was an area called the Ophel. Ayin Pelamid. And it was a special space that was elevated above everything else. Ophel means heights. He says that's the term for apolim. It means heights. In other words, well, v'akriyu shem acholi, whereas the pronounced word, the word tchorim, is the name of this bowel illness. What's being described in the case in Devarim 28, as well as in Shmuel, is someone being struck with a bowel ailment, which is what you will say when you read the text aloud. Well, hang on. When you read the text out loud, when the Baal Kriya lanes it in Shul, they will lane it as the word is intended to mean, which is, it's going to say, God is going to strike them with, or in Shmuel, they were struck with, Tchorim. That's what it's going to say. However, when you look at the biblical text, in the case of Shmuel, it's the Navi, in the case of the Chumash, it's God, says, I don't want my text dirtied with a word like that. I don't want hemorrhoids in my Chumash. So therefore, I'm going to have it say the opposite as a euphemism. It's going to say apolim, but everyone's going to know I mean tichorim. And I'm taking that idea that Radak does there. I'm almost done. It's the I'm taking that what Radak says there and applying it here as well. Meaning, the word is shegel or shegal, not to be confused with shagal. But that word often means a queen. That's what it means in Nehemiah, chapter 2, sentence 6. That's the verse that I referenced there in number 4 in the parentheses, not the one on Ophel on the wall. But Nehemiah 2, 6 has the word Shegal, meaning the Persian queen. It appears in Tehillim as well at one point as a queen. There's a Gemara that takes Shegal as a negative. But generally speaking, in Tanakh, Shegal is a positive. It refers to royalty. And so what's happening is, the text describes the women suffering from this molestation, and that's the way the word is read when you read it out loud. You say, Tishachavna, they're being raped, so that's what's happening. However, rather than write that in the text, it says, Tishagalna, they will be made queen. It's a euphemism to try to avoid stating the opposite, which is actually what's happening to them. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Now, thank you for waiting.
First of all, there's no connection, obviously, between the two words as roots, like, because they're opposites. Right?
Yeah, no, there's no connection. Not meant.
Who did this creativity?
Right.
So, like, other creativity you can understand because it's just a matter of pronunciation. This creativity is so, if not a matter of pronunciation,
right,
it's like totally different words.
Right. And the answer is we don't have a clear statement of where it started, other than Jews have always done it. We have never found a text, not in the Dead Sea Scrolls, not anywhere else, in which the word is other than what we do. So we have no idea. Presumably that means Jews have always done it. But I don't have an answer. That's my understanding. I want to go back and check to confirm that for Dvarim, Shmuel, you know, and Yeshaya, because I haven't done that. It's worth checking. You know what? Homework. Go ahead. The Susan's got a job. I think it's a good idea to check that. But that's my understanding, is that this is the way we've been reading. In that case, Chumash, Shmuel, and now Yeshaya. As long as we've been reading it, Paul.
Well, you're all fluent Hebrew scholars, so I excuse my ignorance on this. You're saying that there's a word that's being read one way, and the way it's read is literally as it's written, but it's being understood.
What I'm saying is this: imagine the following. Okay. What I'm going to do is actually the opposite of what I should do with this. That's not good. That's not a good way to teach it. I had a good idea, but it's not a good idea.
It's the way nice people talk. They use euphemisms quite often.
Right, but we're writing it as a euphemism instead of speaking it. That's the challenge here.
But isn't rape one of the three big no-nos?
I mean, sexual immorality in general, rape included, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Yes.
Maybe that's just...
No, I mean, it speaks to the horror that Tanakh has for it, that it doesn't even want to write it. It uses this other word instead. Alina?
As told some of the Farshim, they don't want to say God forbid to curse God, so they use the word blessed, like that's the same
right.
thing.
But you don't find that biblically. No, in rabbinic writing, yes, we do that. What you find often is a euphemism, like Paro is one classic example. Paro speaks, since Pesach is coming, Paro speaks about the Jews, right, in Egypt, when he comes up with his plan of killing the baby boys. So he says, Havanitchak Malo, we will be wise in dealing with him. Pen Yir Ben, lest he become many. Vayaki Tikrena Milchama, and it will be when war is declared. Venosaf Gam Hu Al Soneinu, he will join our enemies. Vinilcham Banu, they will fight against us. Ve'Allah Min Ha'aretz, and he will leave the land. So that's very odd. Is that Paro's great fear that the Jews are going to leave the land? Is that his fear? So the Medrash says it's the opposite. He just doesn't want to say it. What he means is we will have to leave the land. They're going to kick us out. They're going to defeat us and exile us. But he doesn't want to say that.
So what's written is.
But there, what's written is pronounced. Everything is.
Over here, when it says, so it's written the heights, and it really means is the depths.
Correct. Got it? That's the idea. The Torah doesn't want to be dirtied with a word like that, and therefore it is changed to something else. This is not the only idea. This is the most dramatic, when you're actually substituting. But the Gemara in Pesachim talks about the importance of guarding one's mouth and not using negative or dirty terminology. And it's part of the whole discussion, the beginning of the Masechet, the meaning of the word "or," which we're not going to go into right now. But as part of that discussion, there it notes that at one point, actually I think this week's parsha, at one point in describing the kosher and non-kosher creatures, instead of saying that creatures that are not kosher are tamei, it says asher lo tehorahi, that which is not tahor. Which, interestingly, English does. What's the opposite of pure in English? Impure. Rather than say contaminated, you say impure. It's just not pure. It's a very funny thing. It also is with Noach and the boat. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of for where it does substitution. Asher lo taharahi. But the point is that we have this idea of care with language, and that's what you're seeing here as well. The Torah is expressing, or Yeshaya is expressing, the horror at this phenomenon by saying, we don't even want to use the word in the text, even though when you read it, you're going to say it, because you have to know it. But in the text itself, we're going to change it.
It's also reason, like, we're using the bad word when we read it. But, so, even though whoever's saying Hashem, whatever, doesn't want to use the word rape.
Yes.
But he wants us to.
Yes, because he wants you to know.
How?
If you don't, how are people going to know? You know, that's the problem. I want to go further with this because Yeshaya. The point though that I think you have to get to aside from that, that's obviously a very important point. But the other piece you have to see here is Madai. What in the world? Who destroyed Babylon?
Persia.
We always say Persia. Occasionally you say Parasu Madai, like in Esther, Persia and Media. Madai alone is mentioned here. If you ask secular historians what Madai Media was, they'll tell you it was a nation in northwestern Iran, 7th to 6th centuries before the Common Era, so they were around, you know, at this point. But the secular historians believe the Persians conquered the Medes in the year 550 before the Common Era. A good 11 years before Cyrus the Great conquers Babylon. So Media had been absorbed by the Persians. The last king of Media, don't do it, just don't do it. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, good. For those who do, also good, but leave it be. The last king of Media was a fellow by the name of Astyages. Astyages was actually the grandfather of Cyrus, according to the historian Herodotus. The Persian historians have some debate on that. But that changes things and puts it in a new light, because that means the last king of the Medes has a grandson who is the king of the Persians who conquers the Medes. That's a fascinating dynamic, and someone should make a movie about that.
Mythology.
Maybe. Herodotus thinks it's history. But now you get to our account of this, in which we have the Medes. And what you find is fascinating, because it seems like, and I gave you a reference for this in number 5, so you could look this up later. On the one side is Yeshaya 13, our text, and Daniel chapter 6. You may recall that in Daniel chapter 5, the Babylonians have their last hurrah. Belshazzar has a big feast. Hand appears, the writing on the wall, he can't read it, predicting the fall of the empire. And then in chapter 6, suddenly, the Medes are on the throne. Darius the Mede is king over that entire empire. He's the one who throws Daniel into the lion's den. So that's chapter 6 in Daniel, and the Persians are nowhere to be seen. So Yeshaya and Daniel emphasize the Medes taking over. On the other hand, when you read the end of Divrei Hayamim, and really when you read the beginning of Ezra, you find out that the Babylonians were conquered by Cyrus and the Persians. And Cyrus is that first king afterwards, and he frees the Jews to go back to build their temple. So this is very difficult to understand. Rashi and Daniel, take a look at source number 6, please. Is important. Yes, I stopped translating at this point, other than number 7, because I already had translated on a previous source sheet. But number 6, we'll work through it. V'Daniel dina haslach b'malchus dayavesh. This Daniel, who survived the lion's den, was successful in the empire of Darius the Mede. Different from Darius the Persian, by the way. Historians don't know who Darius the Mede was. That's a problem in its own right. U'malchus Koresh Parsa, as well as in the empire of Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel was successful in the empire of Darius the Mede and the empire of Cyrus the Persian. Rashi comments there. U'malchus Koresh Shemalach Achar Dayavesh. Cyrus reigned after Darius. Shalomalach Dayavesh Hamadi Elashana Achas V'Nerag V'Milchama. Darius only ruled for 1 year. Then he was killed in battle. As recorded in the work of Yosef Ben-Gurion, this is likely not Josephus, this is a separate work called Josephone, which is much later. And they coronated and appointed Cyrus as king. So Darius got killed in battle, and Cyrus took over for him. That's Rashi's view, and it fits Rashi elsewhere as well, in our chapter, in fact, that Cyrus ascends to power with a separate war. So Darius and the Medes beat the Babylonians, and then Cyrus the Persian takes over after Darius falls in battle. However, there's one other way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, and Ibn Ezra will suggest this, that there's an alliance between the Persians and the Medes. Meaning the Persians, you know, if you think of the Romans and the Greeks, right? The Romans conquer the Greeks. But what language does the Roman Empire speak?
Latin.
Not your common member of the Roman Empire. Greek. They spoke Greek. The conquests were not always black and white. Sometimes conquests actually ended with absorption and assimilation. That's my understanding, at any rate, from what I've learned, that the common member of the Roman Empire spoke Greek.
In 1066.
1066, also a good example. Also, fascinatingly, the page in the Artscroll Chumash that has the war with Amalek. What to do with 1066? I don't know, but it always sticks in my head. But take a look, please, at source number 7. Look what Ibn Ezra has to say. And you have the English now on the other side. Ubisifrei Malchei Paras, it's recorded in the books of the Persian kings, Ki Daryavesh Zehazaken Hayachotein Koresh, that Darius the Elder was in fact Cyrus's father-in-law. Ushneem Tafsu Bavel, and the two of them conquered Bavel. Ki Koresh Hayamelech Paras, Vizeh Daryavesh Hayamelech Madai, Cyrus was king of the Persians, Darius was king of the Medes, and Cyrus let his father-in-law rule over Bavel. He himself appointed him. As the pasuk says in Ezra, Cyrus says, God gave me all the empires of the land, and they reigned simultaneously. He said, here, you can do this, father-in-law. Or maybe he said dad. Depends on the family dynamic. Pretty sure he didn't use his first name. But that's the idea, is that they actually reigned in tandem. That's what Ibn Ezra is suggesting, and it would help. So, again, just to make sure that we're clear, because I've deviated a little bit into history, we're mentioning the Medes here and not the Persians. I have now provided justification for mentioning the Medes. Even though in Ezra and the end of Divrei HaYamim also, it sounds like it's the Persians, nonetheless, the answer could be it's Medes in tandem with Persians, or it was Medes and then Persians. If you take Rashi and the Medrash and Seder Olam, that can explain it. But what we haven't answered is, so why did we leave out the Persians? You just mentioned Media here. You didn't mention Persia. Why not? Yeah.
When was the geographically with the Medes?
Northwestern Iran. That's where the Medes are. Yeah. Where that is in relation to Persia, I don't actually know. And I imagine it varies based on generation and conquest. Moish.
I have an idea. Could they something from very, very recent times?
Yes.
In the defeat of Germany at the end of the Second War. You had the Russians and the Americans, the four armies all closing in on Berlin, the four offensive armies all closing in on Berlin.
Right.
And perhaps it was Medea that took out Babel, the center of the empire, and Koresh was taking out other parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's that place.
So it's just a matter of where they're going to be. Could be. It's an interesting idea. I have no historical grounds not to agree. So I'll add it in as much as explanation.
No, they might have been very, very fierce warriors, like the two national...
So that's Ibn Ezra's approach. Ibn Ezra's answer for why we're mentioning Madai, we're not mentioning Persia, is that the Medes were known for their cruelty. Mind you, Ibn Ezra is, you know, writing this in the beginning of the 12th century. I don't know how many Medes he had ever met. Nonetheless, he says, since we're emphasizing cruelty here, it must be that the Medes were the ones who were extra cruel, and therefore they are going to be invoked. That's one possibility. Abarbanel says this is when the Medes were in charge, fitting with the alliance that we noted above. That's another possibility. Okay. Or we have Moshe's idea as well, different geographic areas in which they were involved in the conquest, and maybe the Medes were the ones who conquered the capital city, for example, which was Bavel itself. Okay, could be. That brings us to the next section here, which is sentences 19 to 22. We're still on page 977. And here you get a funny thing. After we talked about the fear that they're going to have, and after we talk about the universal character of the devastation, and after we talk about the cruelty the lack of mercy of the invaders, then we're told in sentence 19 and going forward from there, Babel will be in ruins. Babylon, which had been the most desirable of all empires, the glory, the might, they're overturned like Sodom and Amorah. They will never be settled again, not through all the generations. Not an Arab will put his tent there. The shepherds will not graze their sheep there. Instead, you will have wild animals, perhaps owls, according to the Dat Mikra as well, or the ostriches, perhaps, and Seirim. We have to talk about them. And the chapter finishes with more wild animals in the palaces. It's just another description of ruins. Why do you need to say this? You already said that they will be brought low. What are you adding here? What have you accomplished here?
It's not temporary.
Ah, so one part of it is that this is going to last. What we're saying here is that this is going to be eternal. I want to come back to the eternality of it, because that's actually not clear cut to me, because people do live in Babylon.
Yes.
So we have to solve that problem. But
the land just being totally destroyed. There's no civilization left.
But we already said that, no? We talked about the stars and the heavens and the earth and the cruelty.
The people are being killed,
maybe.
Now, even though the whole land is being.
Right. Could be.
Desolate.
I can't argue with it. It could just be. This is the result of the devastation that you saw described earlier. It could be as simple as that. However, Rashi here builds off of Seder Olam, and it's in source number 8. He says, this is the double whammy. Two punishments are coming to them in 2 years. First, Darius killing Belshazzar and reigning for a year. And then the next battle in which Darius is killed and Cyrus takes power. And that's the second hit against the Babylonians, excuse me. So he says we are actually predicting two wars. It's not one war, it's actually two wars. So that's another way to look at it. I want to highlight a couple of things from these sentences, and then there's some things that we need to pick out that take longer. But first of all, no one will live there, not even temporarily, not an Arab with his tent, not a shepherd with his sheep, nothing. So Rashi actually has a very interesting note on the tent in sentence 20. Lo yahel sham aravi. You see that? What should that word be if it means to put a tent there?
Yeah,
right. We're missing an aleph. So that has led some to actually say it's associated with light, because you can have a pun. We used lo yahel for light earlier. But Rashi says, don't worry about it. We drop aleph all the time. That's what he says. Yeah, there should be an aleph. Treat it as though it was there. Don't worry about it. Yeah, what's an aleph between friends? What do you do with the eternal destruction predicted here? So Radak says that the city is leveled and then rebuilt by Darius. That's his solution. Babel here is a reference to the capital city called Babel. It is destroyed and now it's a new city. Abarbanel's answer is to say they won't return to their former glory. They won't be as great as they had once been. Okay. And then you get these wild animals. The Ochim are particularly interesting in sentence 21. Rashi says, I don't know what these are. I wonder, what does the art scroll do if Rashi says, I don't know?
They say ostriches.
No. They take ferrets. That's a funny one.
Ferrets?
Ferrets, yeah. The art scroll has ferrets. What do you have?
Which one?
On Ochim.
This one has ferrets. It says, a word that does not occur elsewhere, apparently means animals with a howling cry.
Well, howling is consistent in the area, but what do you have, Debbie?
I have owls.
You've got owls on there, because the art scroll has owls on Benot Ya'ana, which is funny, because we often take that as ostrich. That actually is in this week's parsha. They've got, so you're just thrown off. So you have Ochim as owls.
There.
Yeah, so Abarbanel.
Owl, howl?
Yeah, I don't know.
In those days.
Ibn Ezra says wild animals, likely birds. The Dat Mikra likes the idea that they're birds and provides a couple of pictures in case you were curious. It actually thinks Bayana is also an owl. Go figure. In EO, we had a lot of discussion about the Bayana, because it shows up at the end of the, uh, at the end end of the Sefer, towards the end of the Sefer. I believe it's an ostrich in modern Hebrew, yeah. The message here is clearly one of a wasteland. But it's an extreme wasteland. It's really interesting. Those who were here when we did Iyov, right, will remember this for sure. It's only been a few years. But at the end, when God speaks to Iyov finally, and he says to him, where were you when I did this, where were you when I did that, and so on, he then has a section where he says to Iyov, can you command, and he describes all these wild creatures that live out in the wasteland. And what we understood when we read that was not simply a statement of, look what I can do and you can't, so stop telling me how to run the universe. But it was a statement that there are two worlds on our planet. There is the domesticated world of man, where we feel very comfortable, and we feel like we're in charge, and we know what's going on. And then there's the wild part of the world that we ignore. We'd like to pretend doesn't exist, where human beings are afraid to go because they don't have control. They don't have mastery of that part of the world. And God says, you know, I take care of both. I also run the wasteland, and I take care of them too. And the idea that it's an area that is outside of human possession, outside of human control, is very interesting. And I think that's what he's saying is going to happen to Babylon. I saw a hand somewhere? Nope. Okay. There's a lot you could say. We could go on and on, but I'm not going to. But I wanted to ask you a question. In this section here, in sentence 19, he compares the devastation to that of Sodom and Amorah. So you could just say, yeah, instant and total destruction, check. But is there anything else to the metaphor? Is there anything else that we're trying to say here?
The type of people they were,
right? Justification for the destruction. They're like Sodom. Also, the fact that it's from God. Don't read this as the migration of nations. The Medes needed resources and they expanded. Or the king needed a new conquest to distract from his problems at home. Or whatever it was. No, this is from God. Don't misread what is going on. Yeah?
Didn't we say previously, that I remember when I was here, that everything, that don't think these kings are doing it for themselves, that God is using them.
Yes.
Yep.
No, that's been a theme all along.
Yes,
you bet.
That's no different here, then.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. But I think every time you highlight Sodom and Amorah, you're not just highlighting the extent of the devastation, you're also highlighting deserving the devastation and God bringing it upon them. It's a package deal. I think that's important. And in general, when you see metaphors, you see comparisons, ask yourself, what's driving this? Why choose that? Yeshaya is the genius of geniuses when it comes to words. I'm skipping so much that you could do. I'll give you one example of something that I was going to skip. In sentence 22 in the Hebrew, va'ana'iyim, these iyim, which are some kind of hyena, I think, are going to call out or to howl, be'almenotav. So I'm sure they translate be'almenotav in their mansions. What should that word be in the Hebrew if it's mansions? Arminotav, with a resh. What is Almenotav?
Widows.
Widows. It's a play on words to try to highlight the level of devastation.
We don't know if he did that consciously or...
Oh, no, that's conscious.
Maybe it's not just Chinese.
It's not just a typo. No, it's not that either. Just kidding. Yes, I got it.
We don't know whether these people who are translating really know what they're doing.
The translators? They're not bad. They generally follow Rashi, which I think is a good thing to do. It's just that when you follow one view, you're always missing all the other colors. That's the problem, but that's what a translator does. Translation, treason, and so forth.
Divergence is whether it's an ostrich or an owl or something. I mean, these are not simple little differences.
Oh, I'm not an ichthyologist.
Mammals.
Ornithologist, I should say.
It could just be something that's extremely rare. There's also a real element of poetry. Who the hell heck knows where we're going with which particular phrase?
Right. No, I mean, that's what we're trying
to... One scholar will fix something. Another scholar will say it's just a novel.
Sometimes. I want to note one other thing here, which isn't necessary to understand Yeshaya, but it's important in general in Tanakh. Take a look at sentence 22, please. The last part of the sentence, I'm sorry, 21, the last part of the sentence. Usi'irim yerakidu sham. If I had to translate that literally, I will say goats will dance there. right? Sa'ir is a goat. They translate it here as demon. Oh, there it is. Yes, demons will dance there. Well, that's fun. They, you have what? Satyrs. The same idea of demons, right? The difference is that the satyrs have goat, right? Don't they have, right? They're part goats. So Rashi indeed says Se'irim are demons. In fact, if you look in the Chumash in Parshat Achrimot, when we are warned against idolatry, one of several times, obviously, v'lo yizbechu od et zivcheihem la'se'irim asherhem zonim achareihem. God warns that we shall not bring our sacrifices to the se'irim after which we stray. So saying demons makes sense, but does this mean that the Torah believes in demons? So even Ezra says it's wild goats. Even if it's wild goats, and they look like the demons that people follow. But Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim, Radak, and Abarbanel give a different approach. I brought you Abarbanel because I liked his choice of words. In source number 9. Because he's very strong. Us'irim yirakidusham. He says you could follow the Targum Yonatan, which is a classic and very authoritative commentary to Navi, to the prophets. And he says, he explained it as Shedim, which are demons. And you could say that. V'nikru came, and they're called this, meaning they're called Se'irim, not Shedim, not demons. L'fi she'yiru otam ha'mishugaim kidmutam. Because those who are mishuga, those who are not in their right mind, will see them as goats. In other words, what he's saying is, we don't really buy into the demon thing. Those who are of unsettled mind will envision demons, that's what they look like to them. And he quotes our sentence from Achrimot, V'lo yizbechu od, and so on. And then he goes on to say, V'ashar l'faresh se'irim. You could explain se'irim differently. It's not goats. It's dubim v'arayot. Lions and bears, no tigers. Why? Shem se'irim b'sa'arotehem. Se'irim meaning hairy. Okay. Good for me. But it's just interesting to see it. The topic of demons is one that's much larger than we're going to talk about right now. But it's interesting to see the problem. Do I take the text as accepting the existence of demons? Or do I take it as referring to goats, which people think are demon-like? That's the debate here. Okay, so, yeah.
Do demons go in the same category as superstitions?
So that depends on whom you ask. The Rambam seems to think so. My favorite line on this, which we're not going to explore right now, but I will mention it to you just to give you something to think about for the next 6 minutes, is Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, in a memorial volume to Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin and the Rebbe of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, among many, many, many others. In a memorial book tribute to him, they published notes from a sort of diary of his where he had written some essays. And he has a comment there in which he says that everything in the universe, according to the Midrash, everything in the universe has a parallel in human beings. And all that exists in human beings is a parallel in the universe. This is an idea found in Midrash. The sort of homunculus, in a sense. You have the person, and the universe is the person writ large. So he says human beings have imaginations in which they can imagine things that never existed. Therefore, the universe has to also have an imagination to imagine things that never existed. And that's what demons are. And I don't know what he's talking about. I once told this to someone who told me that's a very Kantian idea. And I said, thank you.
See ya.
So that's when you finish with the other homework, you know, the C-scrolls, you can explain what that means to me, because I'm at a loss. But it sounds very deep.
You're saying all that is real has a parallel with what is imagined unreal, and that's Kantian?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't that. Okay, let's get started on chapter 14, just a little bit.
Okay, neither did anybody else.
So, I don't think so. I think Rav Huttner knew. I just don't. So, sentences 1 and 2 give us a breather here. Moshe, I know, I'm going to get an email from you about it. At least one. Sentences 1 and 2 in chapter 14 give us a breather from all destruction all the time to describe instead salvation for the Jews. And the Malvin prefaces it by explaining that what this is about is to show what we mentioned a while ago this session, which is the destruction of the Babylonians is not only about punishing them, but it's about making way for the birth of a Beis HaMikdash, the birth of a temple. It's the birth. It's their pain, but it's our gain. So in sentence one, he says, God is going to have mercy on Yaakov. He is going to choose Israel. He will put us back on our land. Nations will join us. The stranger will join us. They will be added to the house of Yaakov. Nations will take them and bring them home to their place. Will give the house of Israel a place, their portion on the land of God. I'm sorry. I mistranslated that last clause. The house of Israel will take them in the land of God as their servants. And further, the Jews, will raid those who had raided them and will oppress those who had oppressed them. Turnabout. That's the prediction. The problem is, when did this take place? When is this supposed to happen? So Ibn Ezra and Abarbanel says it's when we come back from Babylon. That's what's being predicted, because that's the point. Babylon is destroyed, now we come home. That's the whole context. Of course that makes sense. Rashi, though, and Mitzudat David, note that in sentence one there are two layers. It says God will have mercy on Yaakov, and he will also, or further, choose Israel. The word ode, also. So Rashi and Mitzudat David suggest that actually there are two layers. This is a process which will begin with the return from Babylon and will continue in the time of Mashiach, in the time of the Messiah. That's Rashi and Mitzudat David. Radak says, actually, the first part of this, meaning God will have mercy on Yaakov and God will select Israel and he will bring us back to our land, that's Babylon. That's the after Babylon. Everything forward, the nations joining us and bringing us home and all of that, that's Mashiach's time. But Radak says that for a reason that bothers me. Radak's reason, and I brought you in source number 10 what he said, but I'm going to say it outside in the interest of finishing up. Radak says it can't be that it happened back then. He says, back then, we didn't have people join us as converts. It didn't happen. So Radak is very troubled. And so he says it must be the time of Mashiach, like the second chapter in Yeshaya predicted about them coming to Jerusalem, like the fourth, fifth chapter in Micha. That's Radak's approach. However, I learned Ezra here in this room a few years ago. And do you remember what we read? We had Gerim. We had 10 different lineages among those Jews, including those who had separated from the nations. I gave you the reference in number 12. I quoted you the passage, Ezra chapter 6, sentence 21. And the idea of them bringing us home was explicit there in Ezra chapter 1, later repeated in the book when we have the expanded edict that we associated with Cyrus, where he tells everybody to send gifts and to support us. You know, whatever they thought they were doing, we discussed at the time. But I think it actually could be the time of Ezra, just like Ibn Ezra says, just like Abarbanel says. Abarbanel also notes, and I brought it on the sheet number 11, you have a much larger conversion push in the time of the Hashmonaim, later in the Second Temple, so that fits as well. But what you see here is a four-step redemption that's being described. Number one, God brings us back to the land. Number two, people join us. Number three, people help bring us home. And number four, those who had been over us are now under us. We are no longer bound to them. I recognize that some people would like it just to go back to neutral. We don't want to be over other people. That may make some people uncomfortable, but without a doubt, that's the vision here. Those who had harmed you are now going to be not only neutral to you, but in an inferior position. There's a lot more to say. We're not going to do it right now. In particular, for those who are familiar with the Gemara in Yevamos, Kashim Gerim Liyasa Kesapachat, that's out of the line Vinispichu. Those who are not familiar with it, I apologize. We're not going to go into it right now because it really requires proper discussion. But what I will say is that Vinispichu is a negative word, generally speaking. The idea of them joining is not necessarily seen as a positive thing. And again, it's a topic for another time. But what I hope we got out of this is the universal character of the devastation, right? It's part of God's plan for the universe. And it's also because Babel extends everywhere, also because it's their personal experience, but it's a universal heaven and earth devastation, a cruelty that is associated with the Medes and that is so harsh that the text doesn't even want it written into Tanakh. We talked about the Medes a little bit and where they came from and their relationship with the Persians. We then highlighted Babel in ruins. Perhaps, again, maybe there are two conquests of Babylon or not. But we talked about the extent of it, like Sodom and Amorah, with all of the different elements to it. Side note on demons. And then the Jews are going to be able to come back and build the Beit HaMikdash, build the temple. Chapter 14 is fascinating in its own right, as Yeshaya turns to address Babel personally and to mock them for what has happened to them. So God willing, we'll do that next week. Just for those who came in late, to make sure that you are aware, we do have class on April 2nd. We do have class on April 9th. We will not on April 16th, that's the Tuesday before Pesach, and we will not on April 23rd. Thank you very much.